He pulled a card from an old-fashioned Rolodex and handed it to Roby. Their contact info is right on there, Mr. DCIS. You always that quick to call in the legal beagles? Asked Roby. I found they're worth every penny of their outrageous fees.
So you have a lot of need for legal services?
Ma'am, this is America. If a businessman wants to wipe his ass, he better have a lawyer on retainer. Roby looked around the office. It was high-dollar decorated, and there was a shelf full of business awards against one wall. You look to be pretty successful. Bar must do well. This bar is one of 20 businesses that I own, and all of them are highly profitable. And I don't have one dime of debt. How many of the Fortune 500 jerk-offs can say that? I've even got my own damn plane. Good for you, said Roby. He put the business card for the law firm down on Cassidy's desk. We're here to ask you about your old army squad. Cassidy looked genuinely surprised by this. He took the cigar out of his mouth. What the hell for? You keep in touch with any of them? Cassidy looked past him and saw Julie peering around the corner of the doorway. Cassidy slowly rose and said, Come on in here, girl. Julie eyed Roby, who nodded. She stepped into the office. Closer, said Cassidy. Julie drew nearer to the desk. Cassidy stubbed out his cigar in an ashtray and rubbed his chin. Damn.
What is it?
Asked Vance. You're Julie, aren't you?
I am, but I don't know you.
I knew your parents real well. How are they doing? Roby said, How do you know them? Like you said, the squad. Curtis Getty and me served together. Saved my ass a couple times in Gulf One.
I didn't even know my dad was in the army until just recently.
Cassidy nodded, but didn't look surprised by this. He wasn't much of a talker.
How did you know I was Julie? I don't think we've ever met.
Because you look just like your mother. Same eyes, same dimple, everything. And we have met, only you were just a baby. Diapered you a couple of times myself. Probably botched the job, not great with little kids. So you kept in touch with them? Asked Roby. Not for a long time. I haven't seen them since Julie turned one. What happened? Cassidy looked away and shrugged. Folks get busy, drift apart. He eyed Julie. Your mom doing okay?
No, she's dead.
What? Cassidy said quickly. What the hell happened? He put one hand on the desk to steady himself. Roby said, She and Curtis were murdered. Murdered? Cassidy dropped back into his chair. The questions tumbled out. Why? How? Who did it? We were hoping you could help us answer those questions, said Roby. Me? Yeah, you. Like I said, I haven't seen the Gettys in a long time.
Didn't you know they lived in D.C.? Asked Roby.
No. They didn't used to live around here. They were in Pennsylvania last time I saw them.
Pennsylvania?
Exclaimed Julie.
I didn't know that. I thought they were from California.
Curtis might have been. But when we got back to the States, they lived over near Pittsburgh. That was the last time I saw them, you understand. Didn't know they'd moved down here.
Vance said,
So you were living in Pennsylvania, too, back then?
Yeah. In fact, I lived with them for a while, long time ago, trying to get back on my feet. I actually knew your mom before she met your dad. They got married while he was still in uniform. I was at the wedding.
Roby glanced at Julie and noted her wide-eyed look at all this new information about her parents. Cassidy continued, Anyway, after Gulf One, I didn't do too well. Got into some bad stuff. They helped me out.
Drugs? Asked Roby.
I wasn't the one into the drugs, said Cassidy quietly, looking away from Julie.
I know my parents had drug problems, especially my dad.
He was a good man, Julie, said Cassidy. Like I said, he saved my butt over in the desert. Earned himself the bronze with valor, a purple, too. When we were in uniform, he never touched even a drop of liquor. But after we came back, we were all changed. The war wasn't that long, not like Nam or WW2, but we saw some serious stuff over there. Lots of deaths, mostly civilians, women, kids.
A lot of guys came back messed up or sick. Anyway, your daddy started using. Pot, coke, meth. Your mom tried to get him straight, but never really could. And then she fell into that crap, too. Hard as hell to get out of that hole once you're in it.
And what was your vice?
Vance asked. I was a drunk. And yet you own a bar, said Roby. Best way to test yourself on a daily basis. I'm surrounded by the best stuff and I haven't touched a drop of it in over a decade.
Julie's 14, so about 13 years ago was the last time you saw the Gettys?
That's what I said. Roby looked around the spacious office. The Gettys were pretty down in their luck. Might have been good if you'd returned the favor and helped them out. Cassidy said, would have been glad to do it if I could have found them.
He opened his desk drawer and pushed a button located on the inside of it. A portrait of a woman on a horse on the wall behind his desk clicked open, revealing a safe.
He opened the safe, pulled out a stack of letters, and held them up. Letters I wrote to your parents, Julie, over the years. All returned unopened, addressee unknown. I spent a lot of time and money trying to find you all. Never thought to look in my own backyard. He tossed the letters down on his desk and sat back in his chair. I can't believe they're dead, he said, his voice quavering. He wiped at his eyes and shook his head. Roby looked at the letters. A lot of effort went into those. Like I said, they were my friends. Curtis saved my life. They helped me when I needed it. He looked at Julie. If your parents are gone, who are you staying with? Who's taking care of you?
Them, for now,
said Julie, indicating Roby and Vance. Is she in protective custody or something? Asked Cassidy. Or something, replied Roby. Cassidy looked at Julie. I can help you. I would like to help you, just like I wanted to help your parents. We can talk about that later, said Roby. Is there nothing else you can tell us about Getty, or the other members of the squad? Like I said, I haven't kept in touch. Do you remember Gabriel Siegel and Elizabeth Clare?
Yeah, I do. How are they doing?
Not so great, actually. How about Rick Wind?
Yeah, he was a good guy. Fine soldier.
He's dead now, too. So is Leo Broom. Cassidy stood and slapped his desktop.
All these people from my old squad have been killed?
Not all of them, but the mortality rate is higher than we'd like to see,
said Vance dryly.
Should I be worried? Asked Cassidy.
I think everyone should be worried, replied Roby. Chapter 85. As they walked back to the car, Roby said, We visited all three, and nothing happened.
Meaning they didn't tip their hand as to which one was important,
said Vance. Smart move, actually.
Maybe it didn't matter. Siegel didn't know anything except that Van Buren was in a hospice. Van Buren couldn't tell you anything because she's terminal. Cassidy was a little strange, though.
Julie said,
I liked him. He sort of reminded me a little of my dad.
Roby said, He definitely tried to locate your family, but it was odd that he never knew any of the others were in the area. If the guy could afford to look for the Gettys, why not some of the others?
My family helped him, like he said. And my dad saved his life. The other ones were just soldiers in the same squad.
Maybe, said Roby, but I'm not convinced. Vance eyed his car.
You think it's okay to get in it?
I told you about the special features, but if it makes you feel any better, I'll get in first and start it up.
Roby, you don't have to do that. We're in this together.
And because we're in this together, I do have to do it. No sense in all of us going up in the same flame ball. They waited at the corner while he unlocked the car and got in. Vance and Julie tensed noticeably when he started the engine. When nothing happened, they both let out long breaths at the same time. He drove to the corner and they climbed in.
Now where?
Asked Vance. Back to our little HQ. Compare notes. Think it through and come up with new leads.
I don't see anything to think through,
grumbled Julie. You'd be surprised.
Well, let's hope we're surprised,
said Vance.
because I don't see any daylight in all this either.
Traffic was just as bad heading west, and it was well over 90 minutes later before they were seated at the table in the farmhouse kitchen staring at each other. They'd grabbed some burgers and fries on the way back and had eaten in the car, but while their bellies were full, their heads were still empty of any promising leads.
Okay, let's go through it again, said Roby.
Do we have to?
Said Julie.
It seems like a waste of time. Most of investigative work can be a waste of time, but you have to do it to get to the parts that actually mean anything,
shot back Vance. Roby looked at Vance. Your turn.
Okay, we've gone down some scenarios that petered out. Let's retool and start by ruling out some people. From what you said about Van Buren, I don't see how she can be involved in any of this. She's been in hospice for months. She's got a machine breathing for her. Her husband and daughter are just watching her die, basically.
Roby nodded, and Siegel seems to be just as clueless. He's more concerned about losing his job, and he seemed genuinely surprised when I told him why I wanted to talk to him.
So maybe you were wrong, Roby. You said it was what Julie mentioned about the other squad members that caused them to try and kill her. It just doesn't appear to be the case.
Roby said, but what about Cassidy?
What about him?
He knew the Gettys. I don't personally buy the fact that he couldn't find them, or that he didn't know that any of his other squad members were around. The guy has cash, and cash gets you results. And while he seemed genuinely surprised that Curtis and Sarah were dead, it just seems pretty odd. Julie said,
my mom and dad never mentioned him. That's pretty odd, too, considering how close he said they were. I mean, why didn't they answer his letters?
It doesn't make sense, agreed Roby. Vance was about to say something when her phone buzzed. She looked at the number.
Don't know that one, but the area code is Northern Virginia.
Better answer it.
Hello?
Said Vance into the phone. The person on the other end of the line started speaking fast.
Wait a minute, slow down.
Vance clamped her phone against her ear with her shoulder, pulled out a notepad and pen, and started scribbling.
Okay, I'll be right over.
She clicked off and looked up at Roby. Who was it?
Maybe you were right after all.
About what?
That was Gabriel Siegel's wife. I left my contact info with her.
Why was she calling?
Her husband got a phone call just after you left him. He walked out of the bank right afterwards and never came back. He missed a meeting with a client and a luncheon the bank was holding. He's just disappeared.
Chapter 86. They didn't drive to the bank. They drove straight to Gabriel Siegel's house. His wife was waiting at the door as they pulled into the driveway. Roby led them up to the front porch. The woman looked at him strangely until she saw Vance behind him.
We're partners. Roby, this is Alice Siegel.
Mrs. Siegel, we're here to help find your husband. Alice Siegel nodded, her eyes brimming with tears. When she caught sight of Julie, she once more looked confused.
Who is she?
Roby said, it's not something we can go into right now, ma'am. Can we go inside? Alice stepped back and let them pass through into the house. They settled in chairs around the living room. Roby looked around. The interior had been done mostly on the cheap, but it was neat and clean and functional. The Siegels were clearly frugal. The bank probably didn't pay that much, but the Siegels obviously stretched dwindling dollars as far as they could go, just like millions of other families were doing right now. Vance opened the conversation.
So you said he received a phone call and then walked out. Any idea who called him?
No one at the bank knows. I was hoping the call could be traced.
Did it come to his line at the bank or his cell phone?
His office line. That's how they knew he had gotten the call.
But if it came to the office, didn't someone at the bank ask who was calling your husband?
I think they just put the calls through. It's a business, after all. I guess the person who answered just assumed Gabe would want the call. They don't have a formal receptionist or anything. Banks don't really do that anymore. They've scaled back.
So your husband told me. Did the person at the bank say it was a man or a woman?
A man. Are you going to go there? I mean, isn't the trail getting cold?
We'll cover that end, Mrs. Siegel,
said Vance.
But no crime has been committed, and your husband isn't technically missing. He went off apparently of his own free will.
But he didn't come back. He just walked out. That's not normal. Could he have had an accident? His car is still in the parking lot.
So he might have walked off. Or gotten a ride from whoever called him. Have you tried calling his cell phone?
20 times. I texted him, too. Nothing back. I'm very worried.
Ruby eyed her closely. Is there a reason why he would have just walked off like that?
The phone call. It must be.
Vance added,
but we don't know that the two events are connected. He might have been planning to walk off anyway. The timing of the call might just be a coincidence. But why?
He mentioned to me that you were both worried he might lose his job at the bank.
Well, walking out like that is a pretty good way to ensure that he will lose his job.
And you're sure he didn't try to contact you? On your cell? Maybe on your hard line?
We don't have a hard line. We cut that out when Gabe's pay was reduced last year.
Can you think of any reason why your husband would just up and walk off like that? She eyed him suspiciously.
Well, you came to talk to him, and then he disappeared. Maybe you can tell me the reason.
That was fair enough, thought Roby. Your husband was in the army during Gulf One.
Is that what this is about? But he's been out of the military for years.
He was a member of a squad. We were interested in that squad.
Why?
Roby hesitated and glanced at Vance. She said,
we were just interested, Mrs. Siegel. We wanted to ask your husband if he'd been in touch with anyone from his old squad. I know that he knew Elizabeth Claire Van Buren. They had kept in touch. We know about her. She's dying. We know that, too,
said Vance.
Anybody else he ever mentioned? A few names from time to time. Hard to remember.
Leo Broom, Rick Wind, Curtis Getty, Jerome Cassidy.
Getty. Yes, that name I recall. Gabe said they had been close, but he hadn't seen him since he'd come back. Rick Wind sounds familiar. The thing is, Gabe didn't talk much about his military time. He was terrified that he was going to die because of the toxic conditions they fought in over there. There are soldiers dropping left and right, and the Army won't even acknowledge there is such a thing as Gulf War syndrome. After Elizabeth got sick, he went into a deep depression. He thought a lot of her. He was convinced he would be next.
Julie said,
you mentioned he and Curtis Getty were friends. Did he have any pictures of them together?
Roby and Vance looked at Julie. Roby felt immediate guilt. He had never stopped to consider how all of this must have been affecting the teenager. Alice looked momentarily flustered, but the earnest look on Julie's features prompted the woman to stand up.
I believe he does. Hold on for a moment.
She left the room, and a couple of minutes later came back holding an envelope. She sat next to Julie, opened the envelope, and took the photos out.
Gabe brought these back from overseas. You're welcome to look through them.
Vance and Roby crowded in closer, and they looked through the photos. Julie said,
there's my dad.
Alice looked at Roby and then at Vance.
Her dad?
It's a long story, said Roby. He took the photo from Julie and studied it. The group was standing in front of a burned-out Iraqi tank. Someone had spray-painted the words Saddam Kebab across the blackened shell of the armored vehicle. Curtis Getty was on the far right, dressed in combat fatigues with his shirt unbuttoned, a pistol clenched in his right hand. He looked very young and very happy, probably to be alive. Next to him was Jerome Cassidy. His hair was brown and cut military short. His shirt was off, and he looked tanned, lean, and muscular. Next to him was Elizabeth Claire. Shorter than the others, she looked tougher than all of them. Her uniform was sparklingly clean, with every button where it was supposed to be. Her sidearm was in its holster, and she stared at the camera with a very serious expression. As Ruby looked at her image, he thought it probably would never occur to her that she would be lying in hospice, waiting to die just 20 years later. Alice said,
that's Gabe on the far left there.
Siegel was thinner, with more hair. He seemed confident, even cocky, as he looked at the camera. These days, he was a shell of the man who was depicted in the photo, thought Roby. Alice pointed at two other men, standing next to each other in the middle of the group. They were taller than the others.
I don't know who they are.
Rick Wind and Leo Broom, said Roby. We know about them.
Do you think they might know something about why my husband has disappeared?
They might, said Roby. But he thought, we won't have much luck asking them. Vance, obviously reading Roby's thoughts, said,
We'll check into that angle. I don't know why my husband's military service would come up now, after all these years. Does your husband have anything else connected to his time in the army? Not that I know of. He had brought some things back, his helmet, boots, and some other things, but he got rid of them.
Why?
Asked Vance. Alice Siegel looked surprised by the question.
He thought they were toxic, of course.
Chapter 87. When they returned to the farmhouse, Vance called in to the FBI and got an earful from her superior for going off-grid without authorization. After the man finished his tirade, Vance was able to ask him to trace the phone call Gabriel Siegel had received at the bank. He called back 20 minutes later with the answer. Disposable phone, dead end. He ordered Vance to come into the office right that instant. Roby overheard this part of the conversation. When Vance started to refuse, he grabbed her arm and said, Go, and take Julie with you. His gaze went upward where Julie had gone to use the bathroom.
What?
Said Vance. Things are going to get really hairy very shortly. Vance put her hand over the phone.
How do you know that?
I just do.
All the more reason for us to stick together.
But not Julie. We can't have her in the middle of this. Take her to WFO and surround her with firepower. Then you can come back and hook up with me. She studied him wearily, distrust in her eyes. The voice squawked from the phone.
Yes, sir,
said Vance into the phone.
I'll be in directly, and I'll be bringing Julie Getty with me. I hope we can do a better job of protecting her than we did last time.
She clicked off and gazed at Roby with a searching look.
If you're screwing with me.
Why would I do that?
Because you seem to have a propensity for it. If you have this noble idea that you're the only one in the world who can tackle this thing, or that you're somehow protecting me from danger.
You're an FBI agent. You signed up for this. I have no noble thoughts in my head. All I've ever tried to do is my job and then survive. If I engage in any sort of fantasy, it's that I keep on believing those goals are not mutually exclusive.
Don't try to confuse the issue.
Take your car and take Julie. Get her settled, and then come back here.
And you'll just be here waiting for me?
If I'm not here, you have my phone number.
I don't believe this, Roby. You're shutting me out at the very moment.
Roby turned and walked away.
Is that your answer? Ignoring me? Walking away again? What's going on?
Julie peered over the stair rail at them. Vance looked at Roby and then sighed.
Come on, Julie. We need to get out of here. Where are we going? To run down a lead. What's Will going to do? Run down another lead. Why are we splitting up? Because our fearless leader wants it that way, don't you, Roby?
He was in the next room now and said nothing in response. Roby watched as the Beamer with the cracked windshield and shattered rear window backed away from the house. Vance slammed it into drive and did a donut in the dirt and gravel before careening down the road away from him. Roby took a deep, cleansing breath. He had never played well with others. For the last dozen years, he had worked in almost total isolation. He preferred it that way. He was better alone than with a team. That's just how he was built. He felt an immediate freedom, a washing away of responsibility. He drove from his mind the promise that he had made to Julie, to let her help find out what had happened to her parents. It was a false promise anyway. He'd had no business making it. Fulfilling it, he told himself, would only end up getting the girl killed. Yet it didn't really matter one way or another to Roby. He kept telling himself that as he prepared to finish what he had started. His mind had not changed on one thing. This was about him, despite their detour down to the squad Curtis Getty had been in. This is about me, he thought. And it's also about something bigger. Now he had to find out what that was. This was once more a chess match. The other side had just made a move. Roby had to decide if it was a legitimate move or something else. He gunned up and set out to do just that. Chapter 88. The first stop was the bank. Roby talked to the employees, but they had no helpful information. Gabriel Siegel had left his briefcase behind, but it contained nothing helpful. Yet its presence did tell Roby that Siegel's hasty exit had been unplanned and not related to the business of the bank. He was pretty certain of that already, but in his mind, it was now confirmed. As Alice Siegel had indicated, her husband's car was still in the parking lot. It was a decade-old Honda Civic. Roby picked the lock and searched it, but found nothing useful. He drove off in his car, wondering what had prompted Siegel to simply leave his place of business. Next stop was the hospice. He had forgotten something when he was there before. The guest book. The receptionist let him look at it. While she was attending to other business, he took photos of the pages for the last month or so. Then he walked down the hall to Elizabeth Van Buren's room. Nothing much had changed. She was still lying in the bed with a big pipe stuck down her throat. The sun was still coming in the windows. There were flowers, the photo of the family. And she was still dying. Hanging on to life, probably because she was a soldier, and it was just part of her psyche. And the ventilator didn't hurt. At some point, the family would have to make a decision about that. Like the nurse had said, this place wasn't designed to cure or even prolong life. It was to let folks die with dignity, in comfort, in peace. As he stared at Van Buren, Roby decided she didn't look too peaceful. They should just let her go. Just let her pass to a place better than this one. He picked up the photo and stared at it. A nice family. Alexandra Van Buren was pretty, with soft brunette hair, a playful smile. Roby liked how the camera had captured the energy in her eyes, the life there. The dad looked rugged, but weary and haunted, as though he might have predicted the fate that would befall his wife in the not-too-distant future. At some point in his life, Roby had supposed he could have had a family like this. He was long past that, of course. But sometimes he still thought about it. Right at that instant, Annie Lambert's face appeared in his thoughts. He shook his head clear. He just didn't see how something like that was possible. He walked back out into the fading sunshine and set off for Arlington, to the bar that Jerome Cassidy had built. He made good time and pulled to a stop in front of the bar at around 5 o'clock. He walked in, ordered a beer, and asked for Cassidy. The man came out a few minutes later and approached Roby, an uncertain look on his face. He eyed the beer like it was a stick of TNT about to go off. "Like to talk to you," said Roby.
"What about?"
"Julie."
"What about her?"
"You planning on telling her you're her father?"
"Let's go sit."
Cassidy led him over to a booth in a corner. There were about 15 customers in the place. They settled in their seats, and Cassidy said,
"Early drinking crowd comes in around 5:30. Place will be full by 7. Standing room only by 8. Empties out around 11:30. DC plays hard and works hard. Folks get up early, especially the ones in uniform."
Roby cradled his beer but didn't drink it. He waited for Cassidy to pull the trigger on answering his question. The man finally sat back, slid his palms along the top of the table, and looked at Roby.
"First, how the hell did you know?"
"Guys don't write bundles of letters to friends, especially guy friends. You don't spend time and money tracking them down. And I saw how your face lit up when Julie walked in. You hadn't seen her since she was a baby, but you knew who it was instantly. Not that hard to figure out, actually. And I recently saw a photo of you when you were in uniform 20 years ago. There may be a lot of her mother in Julie, but there's some of you, too." Cassidy blew out a long breath and nodded.
"Think she knows?"
"No, I don't. Would it matter to you?"
"Probably."
"So you thinking of telling her?"
You think I should?
Why don't you tell me what happened first?
Not much to tell, really. And I've got nothing to be ashamed of. I cared for Sarah. This was before she was married to Curtis, and she cared for me. And then Curtis came along. She and him just hit it off right from the first minute. Love at first sight. Stronger than anything we had. I didn't feel bitter about it. I didn't love Sarah like Curtis did. And like I said, he saved my life. He was a good guy. Why not let him have some happiness?
But Julie?
Stupid one last roll in the bed. Curtis thought Julie was his. Sarah knew better. I knew better. But I never said a word.
You seem to be an impossibly good person on that score, remarked Roby.
Cassidy said, I'm not a saint. Never claimed to be. Done lots of people wrong in my life, especially when I'd been drinking. But Sarah and Curtis, well, they just belonged together. And there was no way I could take care of a kid. It was an easy out for me, you see. Nothing noble about it.
Not so easy now.
Cassidy eyed the full beer.
Roby said, You want it?
Cassidy rubbed his palms together. No, I don't. I do want it, but no.
Roby took a sip of the beer and set it back down.
Not so easy now, he said again. Older you get, the more regrets pile on you. I never had any intention of trying to take Julie away, never. I just wanted to see her, see what sort of person she'd become. But by then, I'd left Pennsylvania. By the time I got around to trying to find them, they'd left too, looked everywhere, except for right here.
He paused and eyed Roby.
What's going on here? Feds involved, people getting killed, Julie in the middle of it?
Can't tell you. What I can tell you is that Julie will need a friend after all of this is over.
I want to help her.
We'll just have to see how it plays out. I can't make any promises.
I am her dad.
Her biological dad, maybe.
You don't believe me?
I don't believe anybody anymore. Cassidy started to say something, but then stopped and smiled.
Hell me either, Roby.
He gazed out the window.
So I told you my side. You think I should tell Julie?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to advise you on that. Never been married, never had any kids.
Well, let's assume you are the best person. What would you advise?
She loved her parents. She wanted their lives to be better than they were. She wants to find out why they were killed. She wants to avenge them.
So you're saying not to tell her?
I'm saying my answer might be different tomorrow than it is today. But you're the only one who could really make the call.
Roby stood and eyed the beer.
You're gonna make it.
Cassidy stared up at him.
Why?
You turn down a perfectly good beer under these circumstances. You can turn it down under any circumstances. I'll be in touch.
Chapter 89. Roby didn't know why he had come back here. It was the apartment across the street. He opened the door, turned off the alarm, and stood looking around. He had this place. He had his apartment across the street and the farmhouse. Each place was supposed to be safe, secure, and yet they weren't. So Roby felt homeless. He half expected someone to walk down the hall and ask him what he was doing here. He looked at his watch. It was almost 7 o'clock. He called Vance, but it had gone straight to voicemail. She was probably enduring some difficult times with her boss for going off-grid. He doubted she would be getting back to him anytime soon. And he was actually relieved about that. He'd texted Julie and received a terse response. She no doubt was furious that she'd been snookered into going into protective custody again. At least she would get to grow up, do something wonderful with that big brain of hers. After leaving Cassidy, he had driven around. He'd ridden to the scene of the bus explosion, then over to Donnelly's, which was still closed. Indeed, Roby doubted it would ever reopen. Who would want to grab a drink or have a meal in a place where so many people had lost their lives? Now he was here, and he wasn't sure why. He looked at the telescope, drew closer to it, and finally bent over slightly and gazed through it. His condo building immediately came into focus. He shifted the viewing angle slightly and looked at the line of windows representing his space. It was dark, it was supposed to be. He moved the telescope to the left, and his gaze flitted over the lighted hallway running past all the apartments on that floor. His gaze shifted, as he knew it would, to Annie Lambert's place. Her windows were also dark. She was probably still at work. He wondered if her day off had gone well. He hoped it had. She deserved it. As he watched, he saw her come down the street on her bike. He continued to watch as she walked her bike into the building. Counting off the seconds in his head, he positioned the telescope so that it was right on the elevator bank on his floor. The doors opened a few seconds later, and Lambert got off, rolling her bike next to her. She unlocked the door to her apartment and went inside. Roby moved the telescope and watched as she parked her bike against the wall, took off her jacket and tennis shoes, and padded down the hall in her socks. She made a stop at the bathroom. When she came back out, she continued down the hall. Roby lost her, but picked her back up again about a minute later. She'd taken her blouse off and replaced it with a sweatshirt. Part of him wanted to go over and see her. Then he saw her lift up a long black dress in a hanger with a sheet of plastic over it. It had been draped over a chair. She took the plastic off and held the dress up to her. It was a strapless gown, Roby could see. She lifted up another garment. It was a matching jacket. The last item she picked up were 3-inch black heels. Annie Lambert was going out on the town tonight, it seemed. And why shouldn't she? Thought Roby. Part of him felt jealous, though. It was an odd emotion for him. It didn't sit well. He sat down, put his feet up on a leather ottoman, and gazed at the ceiling. He was so tired, couldn't remember the last time he'd truly slept. He drifted off and awoke with a start some time later. From the foggy recesses of his mind, he remembered something and drew out his phone. He brought up the photos he'd taken of the guest register at the hospice. He scrolled from screen to screen, not expecting to find much of interest. And he didn't. The only name he recognized was Gabriel Siegel from about a month ago. That made sense because Siegel had admitted he'd last visited Van Buren at that time. He scrolled to another page. There was nothing. He hit another page, nothing again. But then something caught his eye. It wasn't a name, it was a date. There was an entire day missing in the guest book. He enlarged the screen as big as he could. He looked at it closely. Down in the far left corner of the frame, he spied it. A triangle of paper. It would have gone unnoticed by anyone looking at the guest book itself. It was too small. But with the pixels swollen to an unnatural size on his phone, Roby knew what it was. The remains of the page that had been ripped out of the book, probably while the front desk had been unoccupied. Why would someone have taken a page from a hospice guest book? There could only be one answer. They wanted to cover up whoever's name had been written in there. They wanted to wipe away the record of someone who had visited Elizabeth Van Buren. Was it Broome, Getty, Wind? Two of them? All three? Siegel had told him that he hadn't seen Broome for 10 years, and hadn't seen Wind or Getty since Gulf One. Cassidy had said he hadn't seen any of them since the war, except for Getty. But what if Broome or Getty or Wind had found out that Van Buren was here, and had come to visit her while she was still lucid? Siegel had said she was in and out of it. And had she let something slip? Something that had led to all three of them having to be silenced? It seemed a bizarre notion, but it was no more strange than any of the other theories that had floated through Roby's mind lately. Roby looked at the date before and after the missing page, 8 days ago. That would fit with the timeline. Siegel hadn't been targeted since he'd stopped coming a month ago. Rick Wind had been the first to die. Counting back, it seemed that Wind might have been killed shortly after he had possibly visited Van Buren. And if Curtis Getty hadn't come to the hospice, That would explain the heated discussion that the waitress at the diner, Cheryl Kossman, had witnessed. Broom had told Getty. He then might have told Wynn. Or it could have been the other way around. Roby couldn't know for sure without seeing which of them had visited the woman. Getty didn't have a car, so it was doubtful he had driven all the way out to Manassas. No chance could be taken. Husbands, wives, and an ex-wife, who was also a potentially dangerous government lawyer, had to be killed. The Brooms had managed to escape, for a time. But with Roby's involuntary help, they had managed to get them too. Roby's mind next drew to the timing of the insertion of the ventilator. It kept a terminally ill woman alive. But it also did something else. It prevented her from saying anything during her lucid moments. From saying anything else, he thought. They had put the tube in her to shut the poor woman up. But whatever she had told, one or more of her former squad members had been the reason they had been killed. Roby raced out of his apartment and took the elevator down. He had a hospice visit to make. Chapter 90. Visiting hours were over, but Roby's repeated raps on the glass front door brought an attendant. He flashed his badge and was allowed in. "I need to see Elizabeth Van Buren," he said, "and I need to see her now."
"That's not possible,"
said the attendant, a woman in her 30s with short blonde hair. "She hasn't been transferred out of hospice, has she?" asked Roby.
"No."
"What then?" The attendant was about to say something when the nurse Roby had spoken to before came forward.
"So you're back."
She was clearly not pleased. "Where is Elizabeth Van Buren? I need to see her."
"She can't see you."
"That's what she said. But why?" asked Roby, his gaze digging into the nurse's features.
"Because Miss Van Buren passed about 3 hours ago."
"What happened?"
"The ventilator tube was removed. She passed peacefully an hour later."
"Who ordered the tube removed?"
"Her doctor."
"But why? Wouldn't he have to get permission from her family?"
"I really can't speak to that."
"Well, who can speak to it?"
"Her doctor, I suppose."
"I'll need his name and number right now." Roby called and spoke with the doctor. The physician was reluctant to discuss the matter with Roby until Roby said, "I'm a federal agent. Something is going on here we're trying to figure out. The only common denominator is Elizabeth Van Buren. Can you tell me anything? It's vital, or else I wouldn't be asking." The doctor said, "I would not have removed the tube without the family requesting it." "Who requested it?" The doctor paused, then said, "Mr. Van Buren had the medical power of attorney." "So he told you to remove it? Why the change of heart?"
"I have no idea. I just did what he asked us to do."
"Was it by phone, or did he come here in person?"
"By phone."
"Pretty strange that he didn't want to be here when his wife died," said Roby.
"Quite frankly, Agent Roby, I thought the same thing. Maybe he had something more important to do. Although for the life of me, I can't imagine what that might be."
"Do you know where he works?"
"No, I don't."
"Ever seen him in person?"
"Yes, numerous times. He seemed like a perfectly normal person. He was deeply devoted to his wife. He was intimately involved in her care. I liked him."
"But not devoted enough to be with her at the end?"
"Again, I can't explain that."
Roby clicked off and looked at the nurse. "Is the body still here?"
"No, the people from the funeral home already picked it up."
"And her husband never came in? Does her daughter know?"
"I have no idea. I would assume Mr. Van Buren has contacted her. He didn't ask us to do so, and thus we couldn't make that sort of communication."
Roby called Vance, but still got voicemail. He next called Blue Man. But the man didn't answer either. Roby raced down the hall to Van Buren's room. He pushed open the door and saw the empty bed. He drew nearer, picked up the photo, and looked at George Van Buren. Short hair, muscular physique. Roby wondered if he was maybe military or former military. The nurse had followed him down the hall and was standing in the hallway.
"Is this really necessary?"
"Yeah, it really is." He whirled around. "George Van Buren. You said you've seen him. Was he ever wearing a uniform?"
"A uniform?"
"Yeah, like military or something."
"No, not that I ever saw. He was just dressed normally."
She took a step forward.
We need to collect Mrs. Van Buren's personal effects and send them along home.
I'll need that home address.
We can't give out that sort of information.
Roby took a long stride until he was within a couple of inches of her. I don't like playing the asshole, but in this case I'm going to. This is a case of national security, and if you have information that might be able to stop an attack against this country, and you don't provide it to a federal officer who has requested it, you're going to prison for a very long time. The woman gasped, then said,
Follow me.
A minute later, Roby was flying down the road in his car. Chapter 91. The Van Burens lived about 20 minutes from the hospice center. Roby made it there in 15. The homes were solidly middle class, basketball hoops, vans and American-made cars in short asphalt driveways. Do-it-yourself landscaping, not a Butler or Rolls-Royce in sight. Roby zeroed in on the Van Buren's house. It was set at the end of the street. The home was dark, but one vehicle was parked in the driveway. Roby stopped his car at the curb, pulled out his pistol, and crept toward the house. He didn't knock at the front door. He peered in one of the windows. He couldn't see anything. He hurried around to the back, putting his elbow through the glass in the back door. He reached through and turned the lock. He pulled a flashlight and made his way through the house. It didn't take him long. He ended up in the front room after clearing the others. He shined his light around. It hit on various objects on walls and shelves. He passed one item and then came back to it. He rushed over and snatched it up. It was a photo of the Van Burens. Mother, daughter, and father. Mom was in her combat fatigues. Roby's gaze focused on Dad. George Van Buren was also in a uniform, a very distinctive one. White shirt, dark pants, dark cap. It was the uniform of the United States Secret Service Uniformed Division. George Van Buren helped to guard the President of the United States. And then in a flash of synapses, Roby finally made the connection. He was watching Annie Lambert walking down the hall. He had lost her for about 30 seconds, but then regained her. She had changed clothes in those few seconds. And then Roby forgot all about Annie Lambert and took his mind back to that airplane hangar in Morocco. Through his scope, he had watched Khalid bin Talal climb the steps to his jet. After that, he had lost sight of the prince for a brief period. And then he had regained him as the Saudi walked down the aisle of the plane and took his seat across from the Russian and Palestinian. That's when Roby had noticed the straps around the prince's middle. He had assumed it was the straps holding on his body armor. But the prince had not been wearing body armor before he got on the plane. Roby had been watching him closely. He would have seen the outline of the armored vest under the robes, and it took longer than a few moments to put on, especially if one was wearing a long robe and was very heavy in the belly. What had happened was now clear. Talal had been warned about a possible hit. He'd had someone, perhaps a double he routinely employed, take his place at the meeting. Maybe he thought the Russian and Palestinian would try to kill him. Maybe he suspected a traitor in his inner circle, or a sniper like Roby waiting to take his shot. He had outsmarted them all. He had had his double die in his place. Roby thought back to the conversation he had overheard that night. It now took on a critical importance. Something that everyone assumed was pointless to try, he thought. The weakest link. Willing to die. That could only be one possible target. The President of the United States. Now the theft of the Secret Service SUV made sense. They had someone on the inside. They had George Van Buren. And the fact that they had let Elizabeth Van Buren die told Roby that the time to make the attempt was right now. And Talal's billions had bought him people in this country to do his bidding. Then he remembered something Annie Lambert had told him. When the president got back to D.C., there was going to be a big event at the White House. He pulled out his phone, did a quick internet search. He got the results and raced out of the house. Tonight,
the president would be entertaining the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Talal was multitasking tonight. The son of a bitch was going for both men. Chapter 92. Roby was halfway to D.C. when he finally reached Blue Man. In terse sentences, he told him about his latest deductions. Blue Man's response was equally terse. He would meet Roby at the White House with backup, and he would alert the appropriate parties. 20 minutes later, Roby slid his car to a stop at the curb, jumped out, and ran. He was on Pennsylvania Avenue, heading to the front gates of the White House. He looked at his watch, nearly 11. He imagined the party would be winding down by now, and if the attempt hadn't occurred yet, it would have to shortly. He spied Blue Man and a group of men huddled outside the White House front gates. Roby could see that it was a mixture of FBI, Secret Service, and DHS. He saw no uniformed Secret Service around. He assumed it had been determined that they couldn't know how far the conspiracy had gone, so it was best to leave the uniforms out of this. Roby ran up to them. "Do they know where Van Buren is?" he asked. Blue Man said, "He's on duty. We've spoken to the Secret Service agents inside. They're hunting for him now. The problem is, we don't want to show that we're suspicious of anything. Van Buren may not be the only asset they have in there." One man in a suit stared over at Roby. He was about 6'3", with graying hair, and a face that seemed to have a worry line for every national crisis he had endured. Roby recognized him as the director of the Secret Service. Roby recalled that the man's father had been a veteran agent with Reagan when he had been shot. It was said that the current director had become an agent at the urging of his old man, and he had sworn that no president would ever die on his watch. The director said, "You're the one who called this in?" "I am," said Roby. "I sure as hell hope you're right, because if you're not, if I'm wrong, nothing bad happens. If I'm right." The director looked at Blue Man. "We'll move in through the visitor's entrance. We'll attract less notice that way. Hopefully they'll snag Van Buren before we even get in the place."
"And the president?" asked Roby.
"Ordinarily, with any threat like this, we would have already moved him either to his personal quarters or to the bunker underneath the White House. But if Van Buren is involved, he'll know that's our protocol, and may have set an ambush somehow. So we decided to sequester the president in an atypical place. The family dining room, along with the Crown Prince, some of the president's staff, and some select VIPs who we know are not threats. No uniforms are part of the security detail. All suits. Van Buren can't get near him. We did it subtly. Now we just have to find Van Buren." He said again, "But I sure as hell hope you're wrong about this. The fact that you haven't been able to locate Van Buren yet tells me that I'm right," replied Roby. They raced to the visitor's entrance and moved quickly through the security checkpoint there. All uniformed Secret Service had been pulled off interior guard duty and massed in a hallway. They had not been told why. Each of them had been questioned. None of them knew where Van Buren was. He had been assigned to a security perimeter on the lower level, near the library. He wasn't there. All rooms on the lower level had been checked. Roby and the others ran down the hall and up the stairs to the main level of the White House. As they were fast walking down the cross hall toward the state dining room, which adjoined the family dining room, one of the agents with them received a message through his earwig. "They found Van Buren," he said. "Where?" the Secret Service director asked immediately. "A storage room in the West Wing." They changed direction and quickly reached the West Wing. There they were directed to the room where Van Buren had been found. The door was thrown open by the lead agent. Inside, they saw Van Buren. He was on the floor, unconscious and trussed up. A patch of shiny blood was mixed in with his hair. One of the agents knelt down next to him and felt for a pulse. "He's alive, but somebody hit him hard." Blue Man said,
"I don't understand this. Why knock out and tie up your assassin?"
Roby was the first to spot it. "His gun is missing." All eyes went to the man's holster. The 9mm that should have been there wasn't. Roby said,
"He wasn't the assassin. They just needed his weapon."
That way, they didn't have to try and sneak one past security. He just walked in with it, part of the plan. And then Roby remembered the last part of the overheard conversation from the plane hangar in Morocco. Access to weapons. Not a Westerner. Decades in the making. Willing to die. He said, "The shooter has his gun. They have to be in with the president and the crown prince." The director paled.
"You mean part of his staff? Or one of the guests?"
Roby didn't answer. He was already sprinting down the hall. Chapter 93. The family dining room was one of the most intimately scaled rooms on the main level of the White House. It was bracketed on one side by the chief usher's office and could also be accessed through the much larger and adjacent state dining room. The president and vice president would often have one-on-one lunches there. It was not as elaborately decorated as the far larger East Room, or the ornately furnished green, blue, and red rooms. Yet if Roby and company failed tonight, it would be the room known forever as where a U.S. president had lost his life. The group marshaled outside the door to the state dining room. The director said, "We're going to alert agents inside the room that the shooter is probably in there. They've already formed a hard wall around the president and are awaiting my order to get him out of the room." Blue Man said,
"If they do that or start searching people, the assassin will fire. In such close quarters, and despite the wall around the president, the bullet might hit its target."
"We can't just wait and see if the person acts or not," countered the director. "Protocol says to move and to move fast. I should have already given the order." Roby said, "How many people in that room total?"
"About 50, said one of the agents.
"This could turn into a bloodbath," said Blue Man.
The director said curtly, "No one wants that, but my focus is only on the president. We plan to take him out through the chief usher's office and from there to the entrance hall." Another agent said, "And the longer we wait, the less chance we have of getting him out of there safely."
Blue Man said, "What if there's more than one shooter? You could be leading him directly into an ambush."
Roby said, "The shooter must be someone who works here."
"That's impossible," said the director.
"The person was involved in a conspiracy with someone we know worked here. That's indisputable. That could not be an outsider. How many of the people in that room with the president and the crown prince are staffers, correct?" The director gave a start.
"It could be one of the prince's staffers. It was a major mistake to put them in the same room together. Shit!"
Roby shook his head. "Van Buren was found in the West Wing. Did one of the prince's staffers have access to the West Wing tonight? Because Van Buren's head injury was recent." The director looked at one of his men.
"Do you have the answer to that?"
"None of the prince's staffers were anywhere near the West Wing this evening."
"Son of a bitch!" exclaimed the director.
Roby said, "People have been paid off up and down the line on this one, sir. The person behind this has lots of money. No one is off limits. For all we know, he might have bought off a Secret Service agent in there."
"I can't believe that," said the director. "No agent has ever been a traitor." "The same could be said for the uniform division," said Blue Man. "But it obviously happened. One of the men forming the wall around the president right now could be the backup shooter, with the primary one using Van Buren's gun."
"But if there is a Secret Service agent on the payroll, why bother getting Van Buren's gun?" "Something like this, you have a fallback plan, sir," said Roby. "The stakes are too high. I'm not saying there are two shooters in there, but I am saying that we can't responsibly discount that possibility."
"So what do we do?" asked the director.
Roby said, "Let me go in there. A staffer will know the interior security agents, but they won't know me. Let me go in dressed as a waiter. I can go in under the pretense of bringing in something, maybe coffee."
"And then what?" demanded the director.
"I identify the shooter or shooters and take them out."
"How will you identify the assassin from all of the people in that room?" snapped the director.
Blue Man spoke up.
"Agent Roby is very adept at spotting assassins, director."
He drew closer and whispered into the man's ear.
"He happens to be one for this country. In fact, he's our best one. If you need a man who can make the kill shots under pressure in a room full of people,
He's it. The director gazed sternly at Roby. This goes against every protocol and procedure the service has.
Yes, sir, it does, agreed Roby.
If you fail, the president dies.
Yes, sir. But I am prepared to die, making sure he doesn't.
If I can't alert the agents in there about our plan, and you pull your gun, they will shoot you.
It's always in the timing, sir.
The director and Roby locked gazes for a long moment. Then the director said, Get him a waiter's uniform, and a cart of damn coffee.
Chapter 94 Roby pulled his jacket more tightly around him. The waiter's uniform they had gotten him was for a bigger man. Roby had insisted on this. He couldn't allow a gun bump that someone could spot. He had two pistols, one in his holster, one hidden under the cloth covering the coffee cart. He was also wearing body armor, although at least some of the agents would fire into his head if they thought he was a threat to the president. The agents inside had been told that the danger was over, but to still maintain the wall around the president. The Crown Prince and his staff were standing in a corner diagonally across from the president, surrounded by